What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to the show. Today, we're going to be doing a little bit of a deeper dive into the new Dietary Guidelines for Americans that just dropped this past week. Real exciting, I know. But if you've been anywhere on social media, or if you follow any health and fitness accounts or nutrition professionals or dietitians, like you've probably seen about this already, because let's just say the internet is a little loud right now. And for justifiable reasons, I made a video on this topic yesterday for my Instagram. I also made wrote a newsletter for my email list this week as well. Just kind of talking about some highlights, some things that I noticed, things I liked and didn't like as much, and just some key points that I wanted to make so you as a general public can just have an idea of what's going on, why people are up in arms about certain things, why other people are taking sides, you know, just all of the conflicting information that you might be seeing. I know I'm seeing it, so I know a lot of other people are probably seeing it as well. But it is a unique time because every 5 years we get these new dietary guidelines that are produced by the HHS and the USDA. And we were due for one this year. And of course, with this current administration and MAHA, Make America Healthy Again, like these were highly anticipated, to say the least. And there have been a lot of comments and videos and things that have been made about this topic already. But I'm just going to try and collect my thoughts, walk through it in a way that makes sense in my brain, and hopefully leave you, the viewer, with some key points, some key takeaways, and just a basic understanding of what the fuck is going on. But I wanted to give a little bit of a brief history on what these guidelines actually are, because I find that sometimes taking a few steps back and understanding where they came from, where they've been, where we're at today, can kind of help us make a little bit more sense, or at least give us an idea on what a timeline might look like. Because I think some people have never heard of these guidelines before, which is fine, not that big of a deal. But they have become more popularized and become all the rage and all the attention right now. One, because they dropped, and two, because there's a lot of controversy and just a lot of misinformation that tends to be circulating around and has been since, you know, the last year and a half, ever kind of since this administration, RFK Jr. has been, you know, assigned to or appointed to head of Human and Health Services. So what are the dietary guidelines? They're essentially just federal nutrition recommendations that serve a couple purposes. But one, you know, you as the general person or general population, you can go and look at these guidelines and ideally look at what the updated research says on a lot of nutrition related topics, you know, health, fitness related stuff as well, but mostly nutrition, things that you're eating, stuff that we're intaking, stuff that pertain to our diet and the consumption of things. So these are applicable to the general population, but these are also very important because they help guide public policies. And they can influence food programs and what people are able to purchase on SNAP or WIC potentially, or Meals on Wheels or school lunch programs. It's also used for education. There's a lot of messaging around it. So they are pretty important, even though most people aren't even familiar with it, or maybe are familiar with that they exist in the first place. But they do play a huge role in public policy and information and guidelines, and again, recommendations that healthcare providers are giving to their clients and patients. But these guidelines are developed by the USDA, the United States Department of Agriculture, and then HHS, Human and Health Services. And within those organizations, there are advisory committees that are made up of researchers and clinicians and policy experts and public health experts, ideally, right? Like, again, I know there's a lot of controversy around who RFK Jr. has selected for some of these big positions, whether it be in the, you know, anti-vaccination community, or some people will say, and I will say it too, like some pseudoscience type influence from a nutrition standpoint. But his committees have been hand selected, and he's kind of gutted a lot of these institutions. So that is part of the reason why there's a lot of uproar with some of these recommendations and things that people have read and seen since these guidelines have dropped over the last 48 hours now. But the dietary guidelines are updated every 5 years. And ideally, it's to keep up to date with the new and existing body of research that we have on nutrition, and it guides nutrition recommendations going forward. And they are, again, supposed to be for policymakers and institutions and schools and, you know, places that we are teaching education in, food assistance programs. they're not, again, advertised as direct individual nutrition advice for the person. But if you go in there and if you read the 10-page document, a lot of it is geared towards, and I think reads relatively well for a person if they wanted to go on and read, hey, how do I want to adjust my nutrition or what are the recommendations here? I think it would be fairly easy for somebody who does not have a background in nutrition or health to be able to go on, read, digest, and to be able to apply some of these new rules and regulations or principles that they're putting out. But again, more important than ever, like these guidelines shape our school lunches, SNAP, WIC, military meals, hospital food recommendations, like all of those things where, you know, the government or the state has a little bit more control of what they're feeding people and the reasons they're feeding people and things that people can get audited on. So that is kind of the primary purpose, is to be able to update those guidelines and do accommodate to that as we continue serving these populations who need, you know, need to be fed by other entities. So that is a little bit backstory on the guidelines themselves. A little transition into what we've seen in the past. So the pyramid that so many people are familiar with, that we've been honestly just hearing from so many outlets, and they keep bringing it up right now. But the original food pyramid launched in the 1990s. I think it was 1991 or 1992. And we kind of had the pyramid and the revised pyramid, and you could look it up, but, you know, essentially the main critique was that the base of the food pyramid was grains and carbohydrates, you know, recommending 6 to 11 servings of carbohydrates. And then we had, you know, fruits and veg and meat. And then at the top, we had butter. Kind of makes sense why when you hear the inverted triangle or the upside down triangle, there's a lot of similarities on what the new base of the pyramid looks like now compared to what the old base of the pyramid looked like. But essentially it flipped on its head, where carbohydrates were, you know, kind of recommended as the base foundation of these nutrition recommendations and what you're eating on a daily basis. And then as you kind of climbed up the pyramid, that's when, you know, less servings, you know, 2 to 3 servings of fruits or vegetables. Like there's actually a lot of decent things on that. And again, from what we knew at the time, those were guiding recommendations that were put out in things that, you know, we followed. And I say we followed, nobody actually follows these guidelines. I'll make that a point or multiple points throughout this podcast, but even the food pyramid, not many people followed, like less than 10% of the population were estimated to actually follow the guiding recommendations, which ironically, if more people followed those, you know, that original food pyramid, and again, if you look at the actual recommendations, you know, they recommend whole grains and fibrous sources of carbohydrates. It's not that you need to eat 11 servings of white bread a day or refined carbohydrates or added sugars. Like, that's not what the food pyramid said. Again, there were flaws, and there's a reason that we've moved on from that. We'll talk about my plate here in a second. But if people followed that, like, and again, controlled their calories, like, people would have probably been a lot healthier than following the traditional commercialized Western diet that a lot of people are kind of falling victim to today. But that original food pyramid that we had from the 90s was then replaced in 2011 by MyPlate. Now, my plate, if you are not familiar with it, was a visual graphic that showed a plate with a little cup of dairy on the side. And it was a little bit simpler, a little bit more intuitive, in my opinion, and kind of showed portion sizes, a little bit more of a balanced approach, like visually giving people some ideas on what their plate could and should look like if they are assembling it at home or ordering away from home, etc. And half of that plate consisted of fiber sources, fruits, vegetables, took up those quarters. A quarter of that other side of the plate was protein. And then the other quarter was grains, carbohydrates. And then there was a little, you know, cup indicating milk or water or low sugar, non-sugar sweetened beverages. And that was kind of the my plate. And that's the basis that we've been running off of over the last 15 years or so now. So the current administration and this new drop of these dietary guideline recommendations have brought back the pyramid. I forget what their slogan was. I'm gonna see if I can pull it up here. Yeah, they brought back the pyramid. I'm looking at the website now, realfood.gov, which is the landing page for a lot of these documents that I'm looking at. But they brought back the food pyramid and the simple guide designed to help Americans eat real whole foods more consistently. It prioritizes nutrient-dense foods and reduces reliance on highly processed foods using modern nutrition science and support everyday health. So they brought back the food pyramid, which is funny, again, because I keep mentioning that people always are referring back to the old food pyramid that we had at one point, when ironically we haven't used that for the last 15 plus years now. So I kind of find it comical because, again, this narrative that a lot of these people are trying to communicate is that, you know, we've had a broken food system that has not acknowledged health at all and has, you know, never been in favor of the American people and has always been corrupt and not transparent and not on current research, when in reality, if you look at the last dietary guidelines, all 165 pages of it, you would find in there that, oh yeah, this is actually an incredibly nutrient dense type way of eating. A lot of recommendations. It's very thorough. It was up to date with the current literature. And again, there is a lot of overlap with some of the recommendations that this new dietary guidelines is also recommending now as well. So I wanted to paint that picture because a lot of people aren't familiar with this idea that, you know, we've got rid of the food pyramid, when in reality, that was something we ditched a long time ago. And if I'm being real, like, I just don't think a pyramid is a great visual representation for a lot of people. I don't know if it's intuitive. I don't know people who don't have a background in nutrition can even understand what some of the recommendations are when you look at a pyramid. And I think that it is very easy to misinterpret or to misunderstand. And even when I looked at the new pyramid that I'm looking at right now, it doesn't read super easy for the naked eye. Like, we have three different corners. We have protein, dairy, and healthy fats. We have vegetables and fruits, and then we have whole grains. The whole grains being at the tip of the inverted pyramid. And for a lot of people who are looking at this visually, it's kind of representing that, like, hey, we should minimize or not eat any or just avoid whole grains. But when you actually read the recommendations, you know, 2 to 4 servings a day, at least, I'll read them here in a second, of whole grains. They list sourdough as part of whole grains, oats, other complex carbohydrates. But there still is recommendations around eating whole grains. But in this, it looks like they're almost, you know, vilified a little bit and outcasted, because there is a line at the bottom that essentially separates that from everything else above it, which is fruits, vegetables, the dairies. You know, we have meat and butter and whole fat dairy in here, along with fruits and vegetables and canned goods and frozen peas on here. I think, again, we'll talk about some of the things that I really like, but this visual in general to me just doesn't make a ton of sense. And the implication of it is that the very top of this pyramid is what we should be basing most of our diet on, which is steak, ground beef. They have salmon, eggs, chicken up top. Again, with our fruits, vegetables, and then as you go down the list, that's when you see things like our fruits, bananas, grapes, there's some nuts, seeds, no beans, which I think is kind of funny, and we'll chat about it in a little bit too. But again, encouraging this idea that we should be eating whole, minimally processed foods, things that I agree with, but bringing back the pyramid as the visual is just something that I don't know if sits well with every single person who looks at it. And I think could be more confusing than it is actual easy to read for a lot of people who may not be as trained in nutrition sciences and whatnot. So this whole "we flip the pyramid" as a marketing strategy is just comical to me, because we haven't used the old pyramid in over 20 fucking years, right? So we're not necessarily rewriting history. We're not completely turning a 180 on any nutrition guidelines. If anything, the old guidelines, you know, were very similar and just as accurate, or if not more accurate, than some of the new updated recommendation that we have seen in the newly dropped dietary guidelines here. Now, before I go into some of the actual specifics of what these recommendations are, I do want to point out that guidelines do not apply themselves to people. Guidelines are and can be a start of the conversation, but they are not something that really influence public health outcomes as much as people might think. Coming out with a new document or a new piece of paper with recommendations on what people should be eating more of is not something that has worked historically. It's not something that people follow. And I don't anticipate people magically following these guidelines more than they did in 2020 or in 2011 when the MyPlate method dropped. And when we look at data, just researching and observation and survey studies and making an educated guess, it's probably estimated that less than 10% of the population actually follows a lot of these guidelines. So showing people a new graphic won't change behavior. And if we actually acknowledge the things that will change behavior and the things that might make it more likely for people to eat more whole, minimally processed foods like these guidelines are recommending, addressing the social determinants of health is going to be the most important variable that, again, I think just gets underrepresented or underreported or not even acknowledged when new guidelines like this drop. Because access and affordability and time and stress and your environment and resources, money, you know, infrastructure, all of these things are usually what influence people's ability to live a healthier lifestyle more than people knowing what to eat or what not to eat. It's like literally, what are they forced to do, or what does their, you know, circumstances in their environment, how does that dictate and influence their decisions for them? And that is usually the biggest bang for the buck when we start, you know, implementing public policy and actually implementing food and assistance programs and covering certain types of foods on those programs and subsidizing farmers or agriculture or not giving all of our money to corn and wheat and actually, you know, improving some of these food deserts and improving accessibility to a lot of these health promoting nutritious foods that we're all, you know, advocating for. But the reality is not everyone has the same access to that. So we won't talk about the social determinants of health a ton, but I want to acknowledge that we have to appreciate that when we are talking about food reform, when we're talking about public health outcomes. Nothing matters as much as that. We can come up with new documents all fucking day, every single year, but it doesn't matter if the execution of those, you know, food recommendations are actually being followed through on. So you can't necessarily just create guidelines and get your way out of these systemic problems that have, you know, plagued our country for years. And that's, again, one of the bigger critics from this administration in particular and some of the bills that have been passed, is it's actually made it harder for people to live a healthier lifestyle, or there have been more incentives for, you know, bigger corporations and some of these people with higher power to make more money and create the cheapest food possible. And again, if they talk about keeping Americans sick, you know, if we look at the biggest suppliers of a lot of these foods, you know, the people who are making the most money are making the cheapest products, making them really, I'm not going to say addictive, but really tasty and really delicious and really affordable, really inexpensive, really accessible, making it easier for people to grab those things to make more of a profit at the expense of their health. So, the problem that a lot of people have with this administration is this idea that they are, you know, always in the best interest of public health outcomes and making people healthier. And sometimes their actions and a lot of behind the scenes policies, bills, things that actually influence people's health outcomes are not in alignment with what is being said or what documents are being provided here. Okay, cool. Let's go into what some of the guidelines actually say. I am going to pull up this document again, and we're just going to kind of go page for page here, just going over the main points. But I want to talk about maybe some updates, some things I like, some things I don't like, some things that I think are kind of confusing to me. And then we'll wrap it up shortly after that. But if you pull up this document, and if you want, I will link this link in the show notes so you can pull these up if you ever want to check these out for yourself and kind of peep at what we're actually talking about here. Sometimes people just, again, hear secondhand from everyone, but they don't even actually look at the original documents for a lot of things. That pertains a lot to like research studies. People are just like regurgitating information that they've heard from other people and points they've heard from other people, and that just blindly trusting them that that's exactly what is happening or what's being said. So I say all that because if you ever want to look at some of these things, I will link them and you can kind of take a peek for yourself. But the first page here, after we kind of go through the disclaimers and we look at the inverted pyramid on the first page, first bullet point here is eat the right amount for you, which I really like. And this is not new. Like we've acknowledged calories in previous dietary guidelines It's hard, again, to be individualized here because no one's going to put up a Mifflin St. Jor equation so you can calculate your energy needs and your activity factor and then figure out your maintenance calorie range and then apply it to you, right? Like that's where nuance and that's where individualization comes in from an individual standpoint. But just the acknowledgement that calories are important here. Calories do matter, and eating the right amount of energy for you and your body, your age, your sex, your height, your weight, level of physical activity, all of these factors that can influence how much food you need on a consistent basis. There's no particular recommendations, which I don't expect here, but just basic understanding that, hey, the amount of food you eat, the total calories that you eat sets the scene for a lot of these other recommendations that we are going for here. So when they say, you know, less than 7% of total calories from added sugar, that is based on your unique individual energy needs, not your husband's or your partner's or your kids. It's for you in particular. So this is nothing new. In this section, they also recommend adequate hydration and, you know, choosing water or sparkling, all unsweetened beverages, all things that I agree with. And then also just the recommendation of paying attention to portion sizes, especially with foods that tend to be a little bit more energy dense, more calorie dense compared to more nutrient, more fiber dense, more protein dense than some of these other foods, but very general statements there. The next part is about protein. And this is where I am excited, or I appreciate the change in recommendations around protein. So in particular, the recommendations went from 0.8 grams per kilogram of body weight, which is not even a recommended optimal dose. That's never been something that people have recommended, like, hey, you're going to get most of the benefits of eating protein by eating this amount of grams per pound of body weight or grams per kilogram of body weight. Most of those recommendations are baseline minimums, recommended intakes to prevent any deficiencies or to make sure you're getting at least a baseline minimum amount of amino acids, other nutrients. So most nutrition professionals are not and have not been going around talking about how you should be eating 0.8 grams per kilogram of body weight. That's very little. But the updated recommendations here are 1.2 to 1.6 grams per kilogram of body weight. If you do not know how to convert your body weight into kilograms, just take your body weight in pounds, divide it by 2.2, and then multiply that by 1.2 to 1.6. And that is a recommended range of protein that you could and should be consuming on a daily basis. Now, I love these recommendations. I actually, especially over the last 3-4 years, since we've had a lot more research come out on protein meta-analyses and just diving into the research a little bit more, that 0.6 grams per pound of body weight. So if you take your body weight, multiply it by 0.6, that is a very good kind of like minimum, but also like, I don't want to say upper end, but you're going to get most of the health benefits from eating a higher protein diet at that range versus the 0.8 to 1 gram per pound of body weight that a lot of people have been touting and promoting in the space for a while now. We just don't need that much. And there's diminishing returns on protein consumption after you reach a certain limit. And that 0.6 to 0.7 grams per pound of body weight, I find, is a range that I usually shoot for with my clients. A good range that, again, is a good minimum that we get all the benefits we need from having a quote unquote higher protein diet. However, it leaves us a little bit more flexibility, a little more room for foods that maybe are more high in fiber, or maybe someone like fats or carbohydrates more. You know, most people don't love protein as a macronutrient, so not their favorite macronutrient. So if we can get away with getting most of the health benefits at a lower target and then leave room for other things, I find that adherence and health outcomes can sometimes improve, again, assuming calories and everything else is equated. So I really like the updates on the change in protein recommendations. I think that's great. As they talk about some of the recommendations of sources of protein that you could be eating, they list eggs, animal sources, poultry, seafood, red meat, as well as a variety of plant-sourced protein foods, including beans, peas, lentils, legumes, nuts, seeds, and soy. I think it's important that they included that. However, I will say that those plant-based protein foods kind of got snubbed here, and they aren't really acknowledged anywhere else. You also do not see them on the inverted food pyramid that we've been talking about this whole time. And I think that was a missed opportunity. We'll talk about fiber here in a second. Beans as well. There's some legumes in the form of like nuts on there, and or peanuts, or I forget what's on the front of that pyramid, but there's no beans. You know, there's a lot of foods that you just cannot include on a pyramid. I understand why you can't fit every food under the sun, but that's why, again, I think going away from the food pyramid was a victory for us back in early 2010s. And now that the food pyramid is back, when you do that, you leave room for interpretation like this. And the visual aspect of looking at a pyramid is a lot of people are going to be drawn to just the foods that are on the list. And when you look at the foods on the list, predominantly speaking, you are going to be looking at animal sources of fat. There's a big, like prime rib or ribeye steak on there. There's also a whole chicken on there. Fish is great. They have like whole fat dairy on there. What else do they have? Like ground beef, they have eggs, shrimp, right? But when you look at it, a lot of this pyramid draws your attention to the meat section, cheese as well. But there's a big fatty cut of meat on there. And a lot of it is just kind of fitting into this narrative and this bias that this group tends to have. And we've been seeing more often than not, which is eating more animal-based sources of protein, when we have decades of research showing that plant-based sources of protein, I don't know if are superior in all contexts. No protein source is exactly going to be the same comparison, even from like salmon to chicken, for example. But you can, and you do get all of the amino acids from plant-based sources of protein. And we consistently see that when people eat more plant-based sources of protein, health outcomes improve, risk factors improve, risk for cancers improve, mortality goes down. Like, there are so many health benefits to incorporating more plant-based sources of protein into your diet. And so this all emphasis of like all animal protein sources, I think it was intentional, but I think that was a missed opportunity that kind of talk shit a little bit unintentionally on plant-based sources of protein, even though they vaguely recommended some plant-based sources of protein. When you read the fine text, great. But when you look at the picture and the thing that's going to get the most attention and traction, like, it's obvious that it is missing on there. So just wanted to say that. Next up, we have dairy. And dairy, again, is such a nutrient-dense food. There are, you know, a lot of benefits that we can get from dairy. It's got protein. It's got healthy fats, essential fats, vitamins, minerals, especially if they've been fortified. The inclusion of full fat dairy here is a point of emphasis, which, again, I find interesting. And when we get down here to saturated fats and we talk about healthy fats, this is where some of the confusion kicks in. But when we look at all of these protein sources, we talk about the dairy, you talk about butter, you know, a lot of these beef tallow, these other fats that are incorporated, a lot of these being recommended are higher sources of saturated fat, which the administration RFK came out and he had this press conference when everything dropped. And he was like, we're ending the war on protein and we're ending the war on saturated fat, which to me, again, is comical because ending the war on protein, that doesn't make any fucking sense. Like, if you have seen anything marketed to you in the health and fitness space, or if you've been to any grocery store in the last 5 years, you are very aware that the emphasis of protein on labels and products fortified and things, protein cookies, protein supplements, protein bars, protein pancakes, protein Pop-Tarts, protein cereal. Like, there's protein infused everything these days. And the protein industry alone, the supplement industry alone, is worth billions and billions of dollars. So to come out and say that protein has been neglected or not appreciated by previous recommendations, that's just not factually true. And especially if we look at my plate, like a quarter of the plate recommended was animal sources of protein or plant-based sources of protein, just a section of protein on your plate that we're prioritizing at every meal. And that, in addition to dairy or other, you know, protein sources that you might get from some of the other foods you eat, like, protein recommendations have never been lacking. We've always emphasized protein, and now more than ever, there's protein availability in literally everything you could ever imagine. So I thought that was a little disingenuous and a little bit, you know, more propaganda than anything else. And then again, the war on saturated fats, what's comical is like, they are not ending the war on saturated fats, because this new guideline recommendations that came out did not change. It's still 10% or less of your daily calorie intake coming from saturated fat is still the recommendation. However, when you look at the protein sources, you look at the full fat dairy, you look at all of these other guidelines or recommendations that they are trying to make to you, most of them are really high in saturated fat. And if you have a, you know, glass of milk with a ground beef or a cut of steak and you cook that in a little bit of butter, you know, you could be exceeding or meeting your saturated fat intake, daily intake for the whole day in one fucking meal. So I just find that comical. But, you know, when I look at the dairy section, that's the thing to me that's a little bit more glaring. You know, getting dairy sources that are not high in added sugars, great. But the full fat dairy in all contexts, I think, you know, I don't know if that was my favorite way to word that either. And then rounding out this page, there was a gut health section, which I love. I think is great. I think gut health has been a lot of the rage recently. There's a lot of people touting themselves as gut health experts and talking about gut health and the gut brain axis and all of these things that I, again, think are very warranted and very important when it comes to overall health. We're appreciating how much the gut actually factors into so many systems in our body. So including a part about, hey, taking care of your gut health means eating high fiber foods, fruits, vegetables, fermented foods made this list, sauerkraut, kimchi, kefir, miso. A lot of these fermented foods, I think, are forgotten about as well and don't get the same amount of attention some other foods or other dairy products and other things like that. So giving a shout out to fermented foods is great. And then also just recommending this idea of like plant diversity, different colors, plenty of different fiber sources are all things that can feed your good healthy gut bacteria. So I thought that was great as well. Next page, we have eat vegetables and fruits throughout the day. Love it. Again, nothing different, nothing we haven't seen before. Vegetables recommending 3 servings a day, fruits 2 servings per day. You can kind of see vegetables like 2 to 4 or 3 to 6 servings per day. Fruits have been from 2 to 4 servings per day, but many people, RFK included, have come out and said that, yeah, you know what? Eating fresh fruits, vegetables, fruits as well is a proven path to improving quality of life and health and just public health outcomes, and encouraging people to eat more of it is a good idea. And I couldn't agree more. The other thing I really appreciate and I enjoy is the fact that they did not demonize packaged or frozen or canned vegetables, in particular fruits as well. That we even have some canned and packaged vegetables on the pyramid itself. So I thought that was really great, but frozen, dried, yeah, canned fruits and vegetables, ideally with limited added sugars, are all great options, all affordable, all going to be a good bang for your buck for people who are able to get their hands on those. And including multiple fruits and vegetables, different fruits and vegetables throughout the course of the day, I think is great. The healthy fats we talked about recently, but this is where, again, some of this stuff is a little bit confounding and confusing. The thing that I found very fascinating is for a organization and a group, Maha in general, being so against seed oils and, you know, the petroleum-based food dyes and all these individual ingredients, there wasn't really any mention of seed oils in particular on the actual guidelines themselves. However, when you go into the scientific foundation for the dietary guidelines that was referenced or kind of a citation for the production of these new guidelines, I went in, I just for fun typed oils and, or let me just do oil, over 123 different occurrences pop up. And when I start looking through some of these, I see refined oils, industrial oils, processed oils, refined extracted oils, like a lot of different ways to say seed oils, which again, this group has had an agenda to remove like seed oils or to cut back on them. And that's where we saw recommendations of like fast food restaurants swapping oils that they're cooking, you know, canola oil, seed oils that they might be frying their foods in to be replaced with beef tallow. Steak and Shake, I think, was the company that did that. That is not a health swap, because if we actually look at human evidence, it is very clear and very consistent that, you know, oils, these seed oils and canola oil and, you know, these non-saturated fat sources, these unsaturated sources of fat are neutral or health promoting at best. And we see that consistently. And when you swap one for the other, when you consume more seed oils compared to saturated fat, we see heart disease risk go down. We see improvement in blood lipid panels. We see improvement in inflammatory markers and a lot of different things that the narrative is not speaking very highly of in this particular paper. And so I think that keeping that in mind and looking at when we are talking about incorporating healthy fats, we mention cooking with avocado oil and olive oil. That is phenomenal. I think that's a wonderful recommendation. That's what I recommend a lot of people cooking with. But in the same breath, they also say other options can include butter or beef tallow. And then the next sentence, we talk about how saturated fat consumption should not exceed 10% of total daily calories, and significantly limiting highly processed foods will help meet this goal. So they're essentially referring to the fact that like saturated fats in the form of processed foods are the only risk factor when it comes to eating high saturated fats. And our animal sources like the red meat and the butter and the tallow and coconut oil, some of those other things are risk-free. But that's also just not the case, right? Saturated fat is something that we need to be paying attention to, whether it's just strictly in a whole food, you're eating a ribeye with butter and a full glass of milk, like that is still worth your consideration and being mindful of how much saturated fat you're consuming, just as much as you getting some canned lunch meat or processed foods that have been, you know, doused in sugar and salt and breading and have been fried. Like those are obviously two different. And the, yes, I will give you the fact that like ground beef and some of these other animal sources are more minimally processed, they're going to be more satiating, they're going to be higher in protein, lower in calories. All those things are important. But saturated fat, whether it's coming from a ribeye steak or whether it's coming from a prepackaged frozen good from Costco, we need to be paying attention to those two things the same. So this, again, this pyramid, I think, misses the mark. When you look at this pyramid, you're gravitated towards the meat section almost instantly because there's vibrant colors and there's different protein sources. And it almost is like the pictures of the meats themselves are bigger. So your attention is naturally drawn to that a little bit more than some of the other foods. People, I think, are going to interpret this and look at this like, oh, I can eat as much red meat as I want, or I can include butter with every single thing that I eat, right? And when we talk about people who are trying to control like portion sizes and stuff, like not a lot of people know how much a tablespoon of butter is, right? And the fact that like we can get 7 to 9 grams saturated fat per tablespoon of butter. And people are eating a lot more than that throughout the course of the day. So again, I think that this whole like incorporate healthy fats missed the mark a little bit here, because it's encouraging people to use butter or beef tallow, but in the same breath, telling people to minimize the amount of saturated fat that they're consuming. Because that was very clearly what the recommendations have said for a long time. And those didn't change. But I just thought it was funny how RFK came on and made this big stunt and deal that they're ending the war on saturated fat when, ironically, they didn't change anything at all. If anything, they kept it the same. It's just the wording and the verbiage they used around it was very misleading and very different. Next on this is focus on whole grains. Again, I love 2 to 4 servings per day. Cutting back, or we'll talk about highly processed foods, added sugars here in a second, but avoiding or minimizing refined carbohydrates, white bread, ready to eat, like breakfast cereals can kind of be classified in that, flour tortillas, crackers, chips, just like empty calories from carbohydrates. Again, I'm nodding my head in agreement. Most people know that those are not the most satiating and nutrient dense foods, and things like whole wheat breads or lentil pastas or potatoes, complex carbohydrates. I know some of those aren't whole grains in general. Oats, you know, all those things can and should be incorporated into a healthy diet and could add to that diversity when we're trying to hit our total fiber target for the day. But again, we look back and compare it to the actual food pyramid. What do we see? We see whole grains at the very end separated by a line at the tip of the pyramid, which again is indicating that that is the thing that we need to be limiting or avoiding, even though the recommendations are 2 to 4 servings per day. And they're saying like sourdough and oats and whole grains and whole grain bread, some of these things are health promoting and something you should be doing more of. It's just that mixed messaging, again, I think is kind of confusing to the average person. And at least it was for me at first glance. And until I started reading through, I'm trying to make everything make sense together. Last couple of pages here, I'll tie up some closing thoughts. But the section on limit highly processed foods, added sugars, and refined carbohydrates, I think is nothing super new, very consistent with previous guidelines and recommendations that we've seen. But it has some very particular wording in here that I think is unique and interesting, but avoid highly processed, packaged, prepared, ready to eat other foods that are salty, sweet, chips, cookies, candy that have added sugars and sodium in them. And then instead prioritizing nutrient dense foods and home prepared meals when dining out, choose nutrient dense options as well. Like, of course, I agree with that. Limiting foods with beverages that include artificial flavors, petroleum-based dyes, artificial preservatives, and low-calorie, non-nutritive sweeteners. That last line is very interesting to me too, though, because essentially it's saying cut back or avoid or limit the amount of low-calorie artificial sweeteners that you are using. When, again, when we look at human outcomes and human research and we look at safe doses and the ADIs for a lot of these non-nutritive sweeteners, aspartame, sucralose, stevia, these zero calorie sweeteners, we consistently see that stuff like, zero calorie alternatives to energy drinks or sodas. And again, I'm not necessarily telling people to go drink more of these, but compared to the full sugar alternatives, they are far better, infinitely better than drinking a regular Coke, even if it has organic cane sugar in it. You drinking a Coke Zero versus a full sugar Coke is so much better. And I do not want people to be discouraged from drinking a zero calorie soda alternative. If that's something they're going to choose anyway, that is such a healthier swap and you should not be worried about that. It's not going to fuck your gut up. It's not going to fuck up your blood sugar regulation. It's not going to make you crave more sugar and overeat later. In fact, when we see people incorporate that more often, even when compared to water, we see improved health outcomes. And for somebody to have an alternative that's, you know, benign at best and not something that is increasing your risk for other things, like that is a win for a lot of people. And I don't want people to look at these guidelines and think that they can never have a sugar-free drink again and that drinking a full sugar alternative is different. Like, yeah, in a perfect world, maybe we just stick mostly to water and we're talking about dairy, some of these other drinks that have a little bit more nutrition, and we're not drinking a ton of juices or sodas or full sugar energy drinks or coffees that are 300 calories. Like, people know that drinking added calories from drinks is not always the best idea. But if you do choose a drink that's not water, getting a zero calorie, lower calorie option, if it has artificial sweeteners, is okay. And I want you to remember that. I want you to know that. But that was something I read and I immediately, yeah, it's kind of this like appeal to nature fallacy that like everything natural, everything organic, everything from the earth is better and anything artificially made is worse. And that's just not the case at all. And I don't want people to be afraid of an artificial sweetener because someone said that it's a chemical and it's not man-made or it's not natural and therefore it's bad for you. When in reality, when we look at the decades and decades of research on humans, people drinking, you know, sugar sweetened beverages versus non-sugar sweetened beverages or non-nutritive artificial sweetener beverages, like we see improved health outcomes every time. So I want you to appreciate that. Better for weight management, weight loss efforts, which again is kind of the point of emphasis here. When we're reading these guidelines, they mention all of these statistics about how obesity is rising and continuing to go up and diabetes and heart disease, and we're becoming more sick and unhealthy. Like when we have some of these alternatives that can help save on calories, that's going to be a positive over the long term for people. Awesome. Great. And then the other part about added sugars is no more than 10 grams of added sugars per day. So essentially like pretty strict, very tightly controlled amount of added sugars that you would be consuming on a day-to-day basis. Now, it's not that I have a problem with it. I just think there's some nuance required here. And even the way that this header is listed, limit highly processed foods, added sugars, refined carbohydrate. Highly processed foods has a blanket of definitions. It is not a one-size-fits-all food when we talk about highly processed foods, ultra-processed foods. Something like a whey protein powder or a plant-based protein powder is considered a highly processed or ultra-processed food. And if we look again at research where people who consume those, it's helping them meet their protein target. You can get extra nutrients in there, can help people manage calories, help them hit their, you know, recommended protein intake every day, like this guidelines are recommending. Is having an ultra processed food like that bad? No, right? Like what are we taking? How much of of it are we taking? What nutrition value is in it? Like, those are all questions that we can kind of discuss when we're talking about highly processed foods. So I think that wording could have been approached a little bit differently. The clarification under here is just no more than 10 grams of added sugars, which in today's day and age, you can imagine how difficult that is. But like, putting that parameter around there, again, I think is great. And I'm in agreement that we should be avoiding or limiting added sugars as much as possible, because there's just not a lot of benefit. Now, if we talk about athletes and different populations, this is where, again, nuance comes into play, because we might have an athlete who's training for the 28 Olympics in LA and they're eating 4,500 calories and we're relying on Gatorade and, you know, pre-workout carbohydrates and simple sugars and things like that, that are going to help that person's performance. Like, that is very different than a normal sedentary, stressed out American who doesn't get more than 3,500 steps a day, who drinks alcohol recreationally on the weekends, who doesn't meet their physical activity guidelines. Like, those are just not the same comparison. So added sugar has a place. They can have a place. I don't want people to be afraid of it. And when we appreciate the fact that, you know, you can incorporate added sugar as long as your total calories are in check and you are eating to your energy needs, like, that is not as much of an issue as it is when people are just mindlessly eating a bunch of added sugar and eating in a surplus, gaining unnecessary extra added body weight, eating a bunch of crappy food that is highly processed and refined that isn't adding much nutrition value. Like, that's where we need to have these like discussions on how this applies from person to person. Cause I might have some clients who might be listening to this, but who are, you know, lifting four times a week and going on a run once a week and trying to get 10,000 steps a day. And, you know, who's to say they can't have a handful of fucking chocolate chips at the end of the night, or a couple cookies, or fucking Trader Joe's peanut butter cups? Like, those are okay. And those can fit as long as we're managing everything else. And most of our diet is coming from these, you know, whole minimally processed foods like we've been talking about. So the parameters of 10 grams of added sugars or less is very interesting to me, especially when we get to alcohol, because I wish they would have kept that same energy for later on in this passage. Cool. Last page that I'm going to read here, the last half of this article is just for like specific populations, things that I don't think we need to get into. But the last page here is alcohol. And then we have a section on sodium too, which the organization of this dietary guidelines, I know it's just a 10 page like consumer copy, but I don't think it reads the best. And the organization of it is a little random. To me, it almost looks like a 200 level nutrition course that I took in college and like a final presentation that I did of like, give a recommendation, a 5-page recommendation for what it means to be healthy. Like, this is very similar to something that I would have done when I was like learning about nutrition way back when. But when we get to the alcohol, this is kind of the part that pissed me off the most, and something that's gotten a lot of backlash recently. But the new guidelines list, consume less alcohol for better overall health. That's it. That's the sentence. That's the updated alcohol recommendations. Consume less alcohol for better overall health. People who should completely avoid alcohol, pregnant women, people who are recovering from alcohol use disorder, unable to control the amount they drink, people taking medications, family history of alcoholism, etc. And I think this is one of the biggest missed opportunities, you know, especially in a country where we have an alcohol problem. We have a lot of problems, right? Like, we have an overconsumption problem. We have a betting problem, gambling problem, alcohol problem, recreational drug use problem. Like, there are so many dopamine seeking behaviors that people use as a crutch that is considered normal in today's society. And this, in my opinion, from a, you know, a US health standpoint, when we're talking about guidelines and we're talking about not hurting people's feelings and being truthful and fully transparent, you come out with the most vague fucking sentence ever on limiting alcohol is, to me, very disingenuous and a missed opportunity. I've said missed opportunity a handful of times today, but just a missed opportunity to really talk to people about what the reality is about alcohol consumption. And the truth is, there's no safe amount of alcohol that you can drink. Any amount of alcohol that you drink on any routine basis increases your risk for mouth cancer, all types of cancer in your digestive tract, colon cancer, not to mention it's also not great for your liver, other organ systems. It's not great from a calorie consumption standpoint. It's very little to no nutrition value at all. It's a known carcinogen. Like alcohol, like smoking, if any other things on here, like we know that this is something that should be avoided or limited at all costs. And coming up with hard parameters is helpful for people to see. Because for somebody reading this, right, like myself, if I'm reading this, consume less alcohol for better of our health. I'm like, okay, cool. Maybe the 14 drinks that I drink throughout the course of the year this year, that to me is drinking less alcohol for overall health. For somebody else, they might be drinking 6 alcoholic drinks a day, 6 beers a day, a couple of vodka sodas a day. Them drinking 2 or 3 a day is less than what they normally drink, which again, I will take compared to them being full into however much alcohol they were drinking, but having guidelines and recommending like, no, men should be drinking 1 or less drinks per day. Same with women. Previous guidelines in the past were 2 drinks per day for men, 1 drink for women. And then it was reduced to 1 drink a day per men, 0 for women. And now it's 1 drink for men and women or less daily. But having some parameters in there is so important to me, especially if we're going to list parameters for a lot of these other nutrients, recommended servings, recommended percentages, talking about total calories. Like the fact that we did not have that on alcohol to me is fucking mind blowing and just not something that made me very happy when I was reading through this. So I digress, but yeah, that was something that just kind of rubbed me the wrong way. And, is even harder when they have a press conference after the fact and we're talking about the release of them and Dr. Oz goes up and essentially talks about how alcohol is a social lubricant and that, you know, you should be avoiding or drinking as little as possible. But if you do drink, drinking with friends can still be a net positive because you're hanging out, you're socializing, and that's still a net positive on your health over the long term, which is just not a productive comment, not something that people need to be hearing more of, not something that people are going to listen to and think that, oh yeah, I need to cut back on alcohol completely. That to me is a sentence that justifies drinking alcohol even more for people, even if they, you know, don't have a problem or if they do have a problem right now. And I just think that the communication around alcohol, you know, people just tiptoe around it because they're afraid to hurt people's feelings. And it's, again, it's a social and cultural norm. And so many people have that involved in their life, but we need to be blunt and very transparent, which is why I've really taken the stance of calling alcohol out. And again, adding the context of like, I understand the trade-offs and risk associated with it. And I know that less is better. And I know minimizing and not drinking at all, and then being really selective with the drinks that you are choosing. Like that's a life that I choose to live. I am not sober and I'm not somebody sitting here saying that everybody's best life for the rest of their life is alcohol free. Like technically, yeah, that might be the healthiest path for people, but that's not practical. And it's not something that's going to happen for most, but giving some direction, giving some recommendations can and is helpful, even if people don't follow them, just to give some guidance and some appreciation for what people could and should be doing and how far off they are compared to what their daily actions and weekly habits actually consist of. So the alcohol thing kind of pissed me off. And then especially when they try and justify the recommendations and recommend that, yeah, recreational or social drinking can still be positive, because if you look at the blue zones and they drink a little bit of alcohol and they socialize and, you know, they have good, healthy relationships, that everything is better and you're going to live longer because of that. But that's just not the truth. You know, like we don't say that about fucking cocaine. We don't say that about cigarettes. You know, a lot of people are out here taking breaks, smoke breaks on their, you know, work schedule. And is that something that's helping people over the long term? Like, no, there's a lot of reasons why we can, you know, talk about some of these drugs and, you know, people talk about chemicals, like these are the epitome of chemicals that we should be avoiding and minimizing at the doses that people are drinking. Those are things that just, I think, need more reinforcement around, because more people need to hear that. And when people read these guidelines or hear, you know, our HHS talking about how alcohol is okay, I don't think that's a good thing. And not to mention too, like if we're talking about eating more whole, minimally processed, nutritious foods, like if you think about the scenarios in which you go out and you drink and you think about the food, the social interactions, the people you hang out with, like those are not scenarios where people are choosing the fucking salad or getting the veggie tray or for an appetizer, or, you know, ordering the chicken breast and broccoli for dinner. It's like, no, when you drink and your inhibitions are reduced and you are hanging out with friends, like that is when you make worse nutrition decisions and worse lifestyle decisions, and your sleep is disrupted and you make bad decisions from, you know, an impairment standpoint. People start driving and getting DUIs. And, you know, this is why driving intoxicated is such a fucking problem and issue, is because you put everyone else's life at risk when you are drinking even very small amounts. So I think it's something that needs to be approached differently. And this was just a big net negative, in my opinion, when I read through the dietary guidelines, and something that probably rubbed me the wrong way the most. Okay. I know that was a lot. I know I went on a lot of little side tangents there, but I'm trying to look over everything and see if I missed anything. I talked about saturated fat, talked about alcohol, talked about removal of plant protein prioritization and just that being absent. I also thought it was funny, like if you look at the nutrition populations down, there's like vegan, vegetarian, and they're kind of throwing a little bit of shade at like that population, saying that it's very easy to have nutrient deficiencies or gaps, which technically can be true, but that could be said about a lot of different dieting practices and principles as well. And they kind of made it out to the fact that like, hey, if you're going to follow a vegan vegetarian diet, you're going to be deficient and it's going to be a really hard time meeting all of your micronutrient needs, your protein needs, et cetera. Just some slight shots at the vegetarian plant forward type dieters, which I didn't think was necessary. And again, they do that. And then they also remove like plant protein recommendations and just visuals off of the pyramid itself. I thought that was a little hilarious too. But I feel like I've talked a lot about things. Hopefully I've talked about this in a way that feels somewhat neutral. Yes, I have my biases and my criticisms and things that I knew I would be a little partial to or impartial to before some of these things came out, or as I've continued to see the actions, behaviors, the way that things are communicated from this administration in general. But I really, you know, when I look at these documents, I look at these things, I really want to highlight the things that are important, things that we need reminders of. And as always, like, especially with science, nutrition, like we're always improving. And that's the point of these guidelines coming out every year, is that we're making sure that we are up to date with the latest research. And a lot of the criticism that I am projecting here, a lot of the criticism that you're seeing online and social media, I think is being looked at as people from the outside looking in thinking that they're just being overly critical. We're being overly critical and not being fair and being too biased with our interpretation of some of these things. When in reality, like these entities and this guideline, you know, the set of guidelines and all of these papers that are coming out, they're being criticized because they're celebrated for recommendations on things that we've already been doing for a long time, things that we've been saying for a long time, things like limiting refined sugars and focusing on, you know, nutrient dense foods, recommendations that were already previously included in guidelines that we've had since 2011 and even far beyond that. The hard part is this administration or RFK or the way that, you know, influencers are talking about these things is people think that they haven't been prioritizing that at all, or those were absent or missing from previous guidelines. And they're implying that this is a revolutionary step in the right direction that is going to improve public health outcomes over the long term. And at the same time, these new guidelines that we're looking at are making changes that are not evidence-based, like, again, increasing the consumption of fatty animal products and saturated fats and relaxing the guidance and recommendations on alcohol consumption, things that I think we know to be true that are very impactful to your health over the long term, are kind of being slid under the rug a little bit here. And no one's really upset about focusing on the whole foods and all the positive things that, again, I pointed out today, but we're just, again, these people are being incredibly disingenuous and intentionally obtuse when it comes to the recommendations that they are making here. So of course there's going to be critics. Of course there's going to be people criticizing what it is that we're seeing and what we're reading and how that aligns with current data, current research, things that we've learned in the past 5-10 years, and how that's going to shape our next 5 years and beyond that. So they are fair criticisms. And I just want to sit here and I just want to sit here and acknowledge the fact that there is always going to be politics at play. Like, we're never going to be free from politics. We're never going to be free from influence from different types of industries and lobbying groups and organizations that are going to influence these recommendations to persuade people to eat more of their products again, so financially they can compensate for that. Institutional influence will never go away. I don't think that's a reality that we will ever appreciate here in the US, and it's okay, but we need to talk openly about it. We need to acknowledge that. And a lot of the critics that, you know, of the previous food guidelines, the previous food pyramid in the 90s, the My Plate recommendations, some of the other recommendations that we've seen over the years, like the people who are celebrating all of these wins and all of the changes to the food pyramid today, were the people who were not overly, but criticizing the conflicts of interest that, you know, the grain industry and General Mills and a lot of these big corporations and companies had influence over recommendations of how many grains and how many types of foods from different food groups they should be eating. When in reality, that was the same exact thing that happened this time around. Like, this to me was a big win for the beef and the dairy industry more than anything. And if you actually look at the authors and the conflicts of interest that they have to list, you know, most of the people in there have conflicts of interest with those particular organizations and those institutions that I think played a lot to do with the visuals of this new pyramid and also the recommendations that we are seeing put forward, even with how much misinformation or how much miscommunication there was between some of the recommendations and some of the things that I actually read in here. So I don't think that improves public health outcomes. I don't think that improves public trust or interest in the topics either. And I think that the same people who were criticizing the food pyramid or whatever back in the 90s or in the last decade, even though we weren't using the food pyramid again, are the same people celebrating now. Like, it's just, it's a two-way street, right? There's a double standard here. Like, you can't celebrate and turn your nose to some of these things that are happening just because it's turning in your favor when you were very critical and very, very outspoken about some of the shortfallings of some of the things that we've seen in the past. So just some other things that I found kind of interesting and things that I wanted to point out as I kind of wrap up this little podcast here. So I hope this cleared up some confusion or elaborated a little bit more on some of the things that we've been seeing and you know, a lot of content creators have been talking about on social media since these new guidelines have dropped. But the communication around all of this can be overwhelming and it can be a lot. And I find that for good reason, and I think it's an important thing that people are calling out this information or bringing attention to some of these things, because the more attention we have to this, you know, the more we can improve on things in the future, or the more discussions and conversations that we could have with people in real time, ideally to get them to a place where they're individualizing their nutrition approaches for them that are going to be more health promoting and better for them over the long run. And I think that there's going to be a lot of noise that continues to follow from all of these guidelines and all of these things that are going to be implemented here over the next year, 2 years and beyond. But I hope this conversation opened your eyes to some of the things that were happening, some of the things that have changed and why they've changed or why they might be helpful and why others might be kind of dumb. And hopefully I didn't project my bias too much onto some of the topics that we discussed today, but it's really easy for me to get a little bit fired up about this, a little passionate about this, because this directly affects me in, you know, the guidelines that I'm kind of recommending for people. Like, not that I go through and read every dietary guidelines for every 5 years that it comes out, but there are a lot of things that I pay attention to. A lot of times I'm looking for that to provide updated research on a lot of these topics. And I just felt like that didn't really happen this time around. And then we, again, have our leaders going on and talking about, you know, alcohol is the social lubricant. And then RFK saying we're ending the war on protein and ending the war on saturated fat, when those things are not true, right? Like, again, protein was a quarter of the plate when we were looking at the MyPlate guidelines. And it talked about meats, poultry, eggs, seafoods, nuts, seeds, soy, like all of that was there too in the previous guidelines as well. And the saturated fats, like these new dietary guidelines did not recommend more saturated fat. They recommended the exact same of 10% of total calories or less of saturated fat every single day, which is, very consistent in previous guidelines, which again is rooted in more evidence-based in thinking. So I don't know. There's so much confusing and just ridiculous things about some of these guidelines that I can't help but think is just going to cause some confusion for some people who might read them or come across them. And the sad part is it could have been different. And I know it could have been different. And the contradictions that, again, we see are just so confusing. But it's probably because that this type of group and body that threw these dietary guidelines together probably did it on such a quick time frame. And they actually didn't use the 2-year scientific report that was meant to inform the guidelines, the things that inform the guidelines every go around when we do the updated dietary guidelines for Americans. And again, with the hand-selected group and committee of people who kind of observed and implemented and talked about these recommendations and came up with this new document, you know, there's just less transparency. And there are a bunch of people who were involved in the meat and the dairy industries that had some interest in redirecting the way some of these guidelines were read and interpreted for Americans going forward. And at the end of the day, these new guidelines just fell short on a lot of things, and they completely rejected a lot of the original scientific committee's recommendations that were good evidence-based recommendations, like, you know, reducing salt consumption and reducing saturated fat and considering cultural foods and other things that are important for people who are not just regular white Americans who like to eat red meat all the time. You know, so that to me is unfortunate and kind of concerning, but it's just, again, not in the best interest of public health outcomes and science, and disregarding the recommendations from these, you know, organizations that have been doing these independent work for over 50 years. We have these compromised dietary guidelines now that are not truly evidence-based and are not caught up with the current evidence that we have on a lot of these topics that we are making recommendations to the general public to, and that we're going to be making reform to certain programs and organizations that rely on these guidelines to implement some of the structure around what they feed people. So there, I know I'm kind of half-heartedly talking about these uncompromised guidelines, but I'll link those in the show notes as well. And you can kind of take a peek at those too. But those are essentially what the dietary guidelines would have and could have been if this administration chose to investigate, look at that research, and implement that into our own U.S. dietary guidelines. So I'll link that in the show notes as well, as along with the documents that I used to kind of review and research today. But I hope I kept you here. If you made it this far, I really appreciate you listening along. I know this was a lot, kind of some boring stuff, but things that need to be addressed and things that I just wanted to speak out loud. And there's no better way than to talk about it on a podcast when I'm the only one that gets to talk for an hour straight. So hopefully I kept making sense throughout. And if not, let me know if you have any questions or anything that you need from me. You know, you can always find me and ask me anything. So I'm going to end the podcast on that note. But until next time, remember to get the purpose, train with attention, think with confidence as you work towards your nutrition and fitness goals. If you have a good one, we'll chat soon. Peace. Thank you again for listening to this episode. If you found value and enjoyed it, it would mean the world to me if you posted a screenshot to your social media. If you do, make sure you tag me so I can say thanks. Or if you're on iTunes, scrolling down and leaving a 5-star review would be much appreciated. And if you ever want to get in touch with me, you can always find me on Instagram at LukeSmithRD. Thanks again for tuning in, and I hope you have an amazing rest of your day. I'll see you on the next episode.